cultivating the intention of studying this so that we can be of benefit to all sentient beings. In fact, it's suggested when you are studying this text to read it aloud and to read it quite loudly so even the insects will hear and that they get the imprint of the Bodhisattva's way of life. So I was talking to a young man who is going to be taking this course from his bed in a nursing home. And he was asking me, what is a bodhisattva? You know, how should I think about this course? What is the importance or significance of this book? What is just the word bodhisattva? So we'll start with thinking about what does a bodhisattva mean. And there are going to be three words that are very similar to each other that I'll repeat over and over during the course. Bodhisattva, bodhicitta, and another bodhi word. I'll think of it in a minute. But the word bodhi means awake. And sattva has many, many interpretations. Someone who has the courage to train an awakening. Sometimes it's interpreted as a warrior. And a bodhisattva is someone who has a bodhicitta state of mind. So again, bodhi meaning awake, and citta meaning heart-mind. So there's a sense in our culture of the enemy being outside, and a warrior or a courageous person surmounting all levels of obstacles that they encounter in terms of wars, in terms of enemies. We have the classic hero's journey in our Western culture, battling dragons. In this case, it is conquering all the obstacles inside. So the goal in all of Buddhism, the only goal, is to have a wide open heart, an absolutely wide open heart that is imbued with wisdom, so that when someone is suffering or somebody is in pain, you have the wisdom to know what to do, what action will be effective. So we want to have not only the wide open heart, but the wisdom to help others in a way that will really benefit them. This book is considered one of the greatest training manuals on that journey to the wide open heart, and that's why it's so valued. We just have a few more folks coming in. Please be welcome. So the awakened hero or heroine, when we talk about the word bodhisattva, it's someone who has that sincere aspiration to benefit beings. And not only some beings, but all beings. At first can seem uncomfortable to us and even a little bit frightening. How do you even think of benefiting all beings? Not even all humans, but all the animals, all the insects, all the beings with mind. And we can be a little bit afraid of that. And that, again, is why this book is so revered, because it takes us step by step, wanting to benefit one being, treasuring that seed, that aspiration, and letting that expand at our own rate of speed, using logic, using reasoning, using a sense of treasuring the open-hearted mind above all else, that we see why and we prove to ourselves why this should be our goal in life. So we have that aspiration that starts in seed form, and we expand it, and then we step on the path in terms of intensively training to greater and greater degrees. And the book takes us through the complete training from handing one stone from one hand to the other hand to being able to offer our whole body to someone who needs nourishment. So if we think of how did the Buddha begin and how did he develop along the way, it said that at one point the Buddha was in the hell realms and he was a bull or an ox hooked up to another ox. And it was terrible circumstances, and at one point he just had the thought, seeing the suffering of the ox next to him, if I could for a moment, I would carry his load too. And that one seed thought became the seed that led to his enlightenment. At another state, thousands of years later, he was a prince and he saw animals who were starving. And he stayed behind his friends and threw himself off a cliff so he could become the nourishment for those starving, suffering animals. So the one seed thought of just for a moment, can I take this load, became no boundaries. There is suffering, I respond. I respond with whatever I have, whatever capacity I have, whatever material wealth that I have, even my body. But that sincerity and the naturalness and the simple action, the impulse was with the same natural purity, spontaneity, because in the traveling on the journey, all the boundaries between self and other dissolve until there's only crying. And any crying anywhere from any being is that of your beloved or that of yourself. There's no longer any inside or any outside. So this text will travel with us until we grow into that state of mind. What I particularly love about this text is the style that it's written in. It is this one fabulously wonderful monk's inner dialogue. And sometimes he's curmudgeonly, sometimes he's fierce with himself, sometimes he's gentle with himself, but it's all the inner voices that any human being would have. Oh, this is not possible. I can't do this. Oh, yes, I can. Yes, I can. Oh, you're a fool. Oh, no, I can do it. So it's written in the 700s, but it still has the freshness of our minds now, as though it was a good friend. This text, as I said, was written in the 700s by Shantideva, and it was written in Nalanda, which was the great university. In Nalanda, Shantideva was not considered the best and the brightest. He had been a prince, and all of these life stories in the Buddhist tradition start with a royal family because you have to be able to give up whatever the best privilege is in the world and show that there are things beyond the material world. So he started as a prince, and his yidam appeared to him, Manjushri, and said, no, you really don't want to be a prince of this world or a king of this world. You want to study and become enlightened. So he went to Nalanda, and you have to imagine a gigantic university with thousands and thousands of people there. It was so extraordinary that even when you arrived at the gate, they had the greatest scholars at each of the gate that would challenge all your previous knowledge. So you would come in knowing that you needed to be open to even higher forms of thinking. And so he was the one that sort of, on an outer level, skated through. He didn't do any of his duties. You can imagine, he didn't do the cleanup. He didn't do the composting. He didn't repair the walls, and nicknamed him the one who just does three things, which was eating, sleeping, and going to the bathroom. And no one saw him do anything, and so everybody was sort of annoyed with him because he was using the resources of the university and not doing anything. So they actually decided they should get rid of him. Being that they were all nice monks, they couldn't just kick him out. They had to make him want to leave. So they said to him, I love this story. They said to him, we want you to give a lecture. You know, you've been here a long time, and now we want you to give a lecture on what you've learned. And so then they built a gigantic teaching throne that was several stories high with no stairs. And they thought that he would be so humiliated on his day to teach that he would just sort of slink away. And so it came to his day to teach, and he flew to the top of the chair. And then they realized that something extraordinary had been going on in his practice all of this time, and said, oh, please teach. And he said, would you like me to teach something classic? Shall I go through something that's been written before, or do you want me to teach something new? And they said, oh, please teach something new. And then he gave this beautiful series of verses. And it said then by the last chapter he was floating in the sky and then disappeared. So fortunately for us, there were people there who took very good notes, And they were so responsible that they searched the whole planet till they found out where he was hiding, just to confirm that, yes, this was exactly what you said, and they had it, all the verses written correctly. And then you have to imagine it became a bestseller. It became so widely taught and popularized that we know when Shantarshita went to Tibet for the first trip to Tibet, and he was one of the great teachers who came with Guru Padmasambhava in the second wave of teachings in Tibet. It was in the early 700s, and he brought this text with him. You can imagine, like, looking at our whole library. This is considered one of the six indispensable texts. And Shantarshita coming to Tibet, how many texts could he bring? How many could he carry? And this was one of the ones, out of all of the Buddhist texts that he chose to carry, this very simple 10 chapters, maybe 30 or 40 verses in each chapter. So it got to Tibet, and over the years, there have been three or four translations. So it's so loved, everybody wants to then see, can we make it more clear? And hundreds of commentaries. So many people were studying it. So that sense of this wonderful monk keeping essentially his journal, teaching himself the Dharma, you know, having access to everything, studying, and then teaching himself how to put it into practice, this one human being. And then we can think of that aspiration to benefit others. Sometimes we think our aspiration to benefit others is only has a small circle affecting maybe our friends and family. But here his journal has been studied for 1,300 years and translated into hundreds and hundreds of languages. So it really helps us see that our sincere practice, our sincere putting the Dharma into everything that happens into our lives and learning from it, not only benefits everyone that we touch, but it can have effects that we can't even imagine. We start with the view in Tibetan Buddhism that Shantideva is working with. And the view is that all beings with mind, we say all sentient beings, have the capacity for enlightenment. They have the capacity for this fresh, wide-open heart-mind, this heart-mind that has complete wisdom, complete compassion, complete kindness. And the word we use for that complete wisdom, compassion, and kindness is the word bodhicitta, or awake heart mind. So that's much shorter. So again, learning a new word, bodhicitta. And our path to this vast open heart mind is getting rid of all the layers of ignorance. So we may have many, many bad habits of all different kinds. We have many habits of thinking, many habits of old tapes, old wounds, old reactivities. Once all of that stuff is cleared away, it's only this vast, open-hearted mind. So that is the foundational view that we're working with in terms of this. And this is considered a text of all three turnings of the Buddhist teachings, but particularly the second turning, in which we create the bodhisattva intention and we actually take a bodhisattva vow. So in all the Mahayana Buddhist traditions, we take a vow, even though we don't know how we will ever grow into the capacity, we take the vow that we will be able one day to become enlightened in order to benefit limitless, limitless sentient beings. And that vow that many of you are familiar with has two streams. One stream is from Shantideva. So the language of the vow, how the vow is conducted, comes from this text, that wonderful vow that's so precious to us. It's written in a particular kind of format, and I just wanted to give you an overview of the whole text before we start, because the way the whole text is written is tremendously interesting. So it said that, in general, follows the Indian verse that we have as part of our dedication in our prayer books. Bodhicitta, the excellent and precious mind, where it is unborn, may it arise, where it is born, may it not decline, but ever increase higher and higher. So you can think of, if you wanted to think of the whole book, simplest way You can think of it's like that verse. It's going to teach me how to give rise to bodhicitta and how to expand it, how to keep it from declining and keep it increasing. I find the format of the book just so sweet. So the first chapter then is, what is bodhicitta and why is it so important? So if you're going to devote a lot of your life to training in this fabulous heart mind, first you want to have confidence that that's a worthwhile thing to do. If you're going to become so vigilant and so courageous that you're going to apply it to every obstacle, then you have to be convinced that it has that capacity and that it's worth doing, that it is such a worthy goal. If you're going to, like Shantideva, give up the whole kingdom in order to study bodhicitta, you want to know that it is worth more than the whole kingdom, right? So the whole first chapter is on why this state of mind that is pure loving kindness and compassion is more valuable than anything that you could encounter, any other thing. And then the second and third chapters show the method of generating bodhicitta, and then it goes straight through the training system of the six perfections in terms of generosity, discipline, patience, concentration, etc., etc. So many of you will be familiar with, there's a whole genre of Buddhist literature called Lamrim, or the path, and it's every single book goes through each of these six perfections. And I know that there will be people who are not familiar with Buddhism taking this course with us. So you can see that we all want to know how to perfect generosity. We all want to be more generous people. We all want to get rid of any hesitation with generosity and to offer more vastly and reach more people. So it's not uniquely Buddhist, although there will be Buddhist language. I feel that this is one of our great treasures. And in the same way I reread Nelson Mandela and Martin Luther King, this is the treasure coming from the Buddhist world of how to become this great heart, great mind. Also, people may have slightly different translations. That's really not a problem. Just enjoy the differences in the translations. We're working with the Way of the Bodhisattva, but all of the translations have valuable insights. And we're going to go through in this chapter many of the verses. So we begin with the first verse, and the first verse also encapsulates the whole text. And this is a style of writing, in the style of composition in the Buddhist tradition. So the first verse, to all those who go to bliss, the Dharma they have mastered, and to all their heirs, to all who merit veneration, I bow down. According to tradition, I shall now in brief describe the entrance to the Bodhisattva discipline. And I find this first verse quite wonderful in that it immediately takes it beyond culture and dogma, in the sense that it doesn't say to the Buddha, it says to all who have gone to bliss. So that means to all who have found this great heart mind. It could be Grandfather Willem Kamanda in the Native American tradition. It could be Nelson Mandela. To all those who have gotten rid of all negativity from their minds completely and have a wide open heart to all sentient beings. To those who have that state. And then the Dharma, and in some interpretations, it doesn't say Dharma, it says Dharmakaya, but that means that state, that realization. So it's not only the text, it's the text that lead to the realization, and it's the realization itself of the wide open heart. So the wide open heart that they have mastered, and to all their heirs, that means all of their students, all of the, essentially, the people on the path who have gotten to the point where they're not falling back. So the unconfused ones who are propelling forward, the ones that we can count on, the ones we go to when we're confused. To all of those beings who have mastered the great heart, and then to all who merit veneration. You know, again, that's not specific to this culture. To all the great beings who have wisdom that we're learning from. I bow down. According to tradition, I will now in brief describe the entrance to the Bodhisattva discipline. Again, Bodhisattva is the awakened warrior of the heart, the courageous one of the heart. And in brief, describing the entrance then goes through an indication that he's going to go through the six perfections. And he actually sees this in terms of preparing to take the vow itself, and then after training in the vow, the Bodhisattva vow, through the six perfections. The Bodhisattva vow may be a unique ceremony in the Buddhist tradition, but it's also considered the realized intention, the intention put into action of benefiting all sentient beings. So this Bodhisattva vow is when you say, I will achieve enlightenment in order to benefit limitless beings. Although we normally take it in a ceremony, one also can take it on their own, visualizing the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. So we can think of someone like Nelson Mandela saying, I vow to free all beings from suffering. I vow to free my people, but also the oppressors. Martin Luther King, my people and the oppressors, until it becomes all beings. Thich Nhat Hanh, my people, then everyone. So that vow gives rise to an even greater vow. And we see many great wise beings throughout history following through on that intention. And that's very encouraging for us, because we see that we have the same human body, the same human mind, the same seed of bodhicitta within, so we have that same capacity. The Buddhist view that is so positive is that it's a matter of training. It's within our capacity, should we take on the training. When I was taking the full ordination in Taiwan, the tradition in China, in Taiwan and in the mainland of China, is when you're ready to take this vow, they warn you that it's going to be difficult and that you'll encounter many hardships, and you test your intention by receiving burns. So some of you are sitting here, I have 3 burns on the top of my head, and that was the minimum. Some people, you could have done 12. But it is explained so beautifully, not that you're harming yourself, but that you're willing to take on whatever is necessary. And you're willing to follow through with that first step, knowing that it's not an easy thing to do. So back to the first verse, the blissful ones, that is a translation of the word sugata, and it has arrived perfectly, reached bliss, and it has the sense of realization and elimination. So realization of the open-hearted mind and elimination of all negativity. Then if we go to the second verse, this is also very traditional in composition to then say that you're imperfect in your learning. And it's not in any way self-denigration. It's a way of combating any kind of arrogance. So he says, what I have to say has all been said before, and I'm destitute of learning and skill with words. I therefore have no thought that this might be of benefit to others. I wrote it only to sustain my understanding. So he's telling us that when he composed it, it was his journal, and he hopes it will benefit others. And clearly, he's already flown to the throne, and so he's demonstrating miraculous powers, which is considered actually the highest way of teaching, because you're inspiring confidence. If you demonstrate a miracle, then of course people have great confidence in what you're teaching. But at the same time, he's saying, I'm sure there is more for me to grow and learn. I'm capable of more expansion. I do want to say that I have studied this text many times, but if he's saying that he's destitute of learning and skill, I have to say that I have great levels of learning to go. But I love this text, and I'm very happy to share what I've studied with you so that you will, I hope, begin to love this text as much as I do. It's one of those ones that I keep on my bedside table, and I can't think of any Dharma talk that I've given that didn't include at least one verse from this text, so I'm constantly going back to it. So wonderful to see that at every point he's combating arrogance. And then the third verse, my faith will thus be strengthened for a little while, that I might grow accustomed to this virtuous way, but others who now chance upon my words may profit also equal to myself in fortune. So it's a gift that he's giving to us. And again, it's his training manual that he wrote for himself, but now we have it. And now we start into the meat of things. And he's starting with just acknowledging the privilege we have of our particular human birth. So hard to find such ease and wealth whereby to render meaningful this human birth. If I now fail to turn it to my profit, how could such a chance be mine again? When we contemplate this verse just in the context of what's going on in the world today, the fact that we live in a peaceful country, that we were able to get here, you know, walking on bodies with full capacity, that we have all of our senses, that when we go home, there's not an earthquake, there's not a war. We, in this moment, have the conditions to actually study that's precious and it's rare. It's precious to come in contact with the text. We could have all the freedom in the world and we could be sitting on the couch watching football. But we've chosen at this moment to come and study this text together. So there's a preciousness to value in this moment together. So that's the support of the body. And now there's the sense of generating enthusiasm for bodhicitta and looking at the mind as a support. As when a flash of lightning rends the night and in its glare shows all the dark black clouds hid, likewise, rarely through the Buddha's power, virtuous thoughts arise, brief and transient in the world. I love the different texts that use the natural world as a metaphor. So you can imagine on a dark, stormy night here, there's that sense of that flash of lightning and how the lightning can light up all of the surroundings. And you can see the trees, you can see the houses. And the lightning goes back and forth between the earth and the sky. I think it even technically goes from the earth up. But there's a sense of what you could not see before, now you can see. And that's the quality of our prajna, or our awakened heart-mind, being able to see free from ignorance. When the ignorance is cleared away, our ability to see the relative and the ultimate as inseparable, or our prajna mind, is illuminating all of reality so we see and understand. And that these moments are so brief and transient at first. When we're journeying, from our perspective, when we're journeying towards the bodhisattva heart-mind, we might have just a glimpse in meditation. We might have a glimpse in retreat. We might have a glimpse when we're studying a text. Monday, we're back at work, and we've forgotten it entirely. It's a brief, transient, blessed moment due to our aspiration, due to all of the commitment and presence of all of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, the Dharmakaya, or the wisdom potential that we have. We have moments of glimpses. Then we train in holding them, expanding them, understanding them. But this is such a rich and juicy kind of example that we can all relate to, a flash of lightning. So you're at work, you're grumbling, you know, the kids are hungry, the shopping to be done, the wood has to be stacked. We're in Vermont, we're preparing for winter. Then for a moment, a glimpse arises, oh, my neighbor is sick, I'll take them some soup. You know, even if you're unable to follow through, that thought arises, that virtuous thought, brief, transient. So we do see in this verse that it's a mental state, that first conceptual thought then grows into a profound, non-conceptual, wide-open state. it follows, and we'll go through some of the verses that then just look at, are you sure? Are you sure it's bodhicitta that you're going to follow and let go of all the recreation, all the leisure? Why is this so important? You know, these brief transient states are nice, but are you going to really enter into the path of training? Are you going to really go for it? Are you going to take on all sentient beings? Thus behold the utter frailty of goodness. Except for perfect bodhicitta, there is nothing to withstand the great and overwhelming strength of evil. The utter frailty of goodness, except for perfect bodhicitta, there is nothing to withstand the great and overwhelming strength of evil. When we look at, from either perspective, the oppressor or the oppressed, for the oppressed, in, you know, whatever is appearing as a hell realm to them, to have a virtuous thought, those folks in who are imprisoned, can I give my extra bread away? Can I be nice to my cellmate? From the perspective of the oppressor, am I going to enter into the mindset of the guards? Am I going to enter into the mindset of the gang? Am I entering into the mindset of my country, right or wrong? Or am I going to hold open that all these sentient beings are fragile, have families, want to be loved? So either mindset has frailty in its situation. Will I succumb to despair as the oppressed, or will I hold joy so that the people around me can benefit? Will I succumb to the madness of seeing everyone as the enemy and holding power over, or can I see we all want peace in our lives, peace of mind, healthy food, healthy water? So the utter frailty of goodness, there is nothing that can withstand other than perfect bodhicitta. Those who wish to overcome the sorrows of their lives, we're at verse 8, and put to flight the pain and suffering of beings, those who wish to gain such great beatitude should never turn their backs on bodhicitta. Should bodhicitta come to birth in one who suffers in the dungeons of samsara, in that instant he's called the Buddha's heir, worshipful alike to gods and humans. So even in the most difficult situations, even in the most hardened states of ignorance, you can imagine a war zone, you can imagine the person with the rifle, just at this last terrible shooting in the mall in Nairobi, for 1 second not killing one child, or the guard who for 1 second said, I give up fear for my own life, I'm going to run back and forth and bring the people out. No matter how mean, stingy they are in their normal life, their past history, in terms of this wonderful policeman who ran in, no matter what they have done, in that moment of I will run in, letting go of my own life and bring people out, at that moment, that person is a bodhisattva. At that moment, we say how wonderful that thought of that person who could do that action to benefit beings. At that moment, we want to honor them and give them a medal. Just because in the middle of the craziness and chaos for one moment, they had that frail, transient thought enacted. So there's no class, no gender distinction. It's only the state of mind. It's not even, it's like all the actions of your past become no longer important because you were able to give rise to that state of mind. You even let go of your history. I'm helping a friend who's working with her mom who's dying, and it reminded me of a Stephen Levine book where there was an elderly woman who was dying that nobody liked. She was so difficult to be around that everybody avoided her room. Her family didn't come to visit. She was just tremendously difficult. Really someone not nice. She had a meditation in which she saw her suffering as being indistinguishable from the suffering of everyone, from the child lying in the war zone, from another person, you know, falling over in another country. And her heart opened in that moment. And then she became beloved. Everybody took their breaks in her room because she got that state of mind, that open, loving, kind state of mind. So in that moment, her whole history was erased and she became the most popular, wonderful person in the nursing home instead of the one that was avoided because she realized this state of mind. Then Shantideva goes through a whole series of examples, and we're not going to go through each of the verses, but the examples are lovely, like the example of alchemy. This is what changes your ordinary human body into a Buddha's human body. And a jewel, bodhicitta, is like a jewel that you want to hang on to tightly and never let go of. There's a reference to a teaching to Sudana, where Sudana sees the Buddha Maitreya, and Maitreya transports him to a castle, and when he looks out the windows in the castle, he sees each of the different events in Maitreya's life that helped him become a bodhisattva. So there are these lovely, lovely examples, and we're going to go to verse 12. And verse 12 is like a wish-fulfilling tree or a miraculous tree. All other virtues, like the plantain tree, produce their fruit, but then their force is spent. Alone, the marvelous tree of bodhicitta will bear its fruit and grow unceasingly. So right now it's fall in Vermont, and we're seeing our gardens that had produced such great fruit, but now their force is spent, and they don't keep growing. And the plantain tree is said to be hollow, so once it blossoms and bears fruit, then that tree is done. So unlike that, bodhicitta not only expands, but expands limitlessly. And we can think of it in terms of our neural pathways. Once we're created a path, it's easier and easier for us to access that path and for that path to create many, many other roads and expand. And from our perspective, with no boundary, we only become more kind and more kind. And doesn't mean that we're kind every second. It means we have the chance to keep growing and make the mental choice for that to be the course of action that we take. We give ourselves the opportunity to choose and continuously make it easier for us to make that choice. It's inescapable to not make examples here in the country of things that apply to nature. It's like when you cut a path through the woods and you chop down the trees, then you can take that path anytime you want. The trees are gone and then you're just dealing with the undergrowth. So you're clearing a path in your mind to access bodhicitta. And then verse 13, as though they pass through perils guarded by a hero, even those weighed down by wickedness will instantly be freed through having bodhicitta. Who then would not place their trust in it? So again, going back to the example of seeing a moment, even in a difficult person's life, how everything changes in that moment. Because of that change of heart, if we can see that in others, how would we not then trust it? He's really asking you to reason with yourself now, why you want to trust it. Now there are two key verses for understanding that it's a journey. And these are very important. They're very important for everyone because I think we have expectations sometimes that we're unable to fulfill. And when we're unable to fulfill those expectations, sometimes we give up. So we're talking about a bodhisattva vow. We're talking about vowing to benefit beings limitlessly. We're talking about seeing people in our culture and other cultures who've achieved that. And then we're saying at the same time that you start where you are at your own rate of speed. You have this capacity, but you need to start gently and kindly and non-aggressively with yourself. Bodhicitta, the awakening mind, in brief is said to have two aspects. First, aspiring, bodhicitta in intention, then active bodhicitta, practical engagement. Wishing to depart and setting out upon the road, this is how the difference is conceived. The wise and learned thus should understand this difference, which is ordered and progressive. So it's really encouraging us to start with the intention and just get used to the intention and familiar with the intention, and then to take steps that we can work with. So we are continually training ourselves and then acting upon that training and not going way behind, beyond our capacity, getting totally afraid and overwhelmed, and then running back under our covers thinking it's not possible for us, that we don't have the capacity to become a Buddha. So when I'm thinking about this, I like to think about my imagined journey of Mother Teresa. So we're thinking of Mother Teresa, and she has this inspiration to benefit beings. And she has this inspiration to go to India. So I imagine her, the first time that thought arose in her mind, then going more and more into her spiritual foundations and training and looking at that thought and examining how to build the capacity, how to get all the skills so that she then has the capacity to then be in India, being immersed in the disease and the filth and the chaos, and opening up her first hospice. There's the sense of looking to see what obstacles arise in your mind when that intention arises, and then working with dissolving each of the obstacles, and then seeing where you're afraid and working with that fear. So we've had the great privilege here to know Louise Diamond. Louise Diamond is someone who really believed that people could be helped in terms of long-term ethnic violence, learning to forgive themselves and each other. And I've watched her over her life start with one project. It might have been Israel was the first project, making a film of the two sides so that the Palestinians and their Israeli families could just, through the film, hear what their experience was like. And then she took this into larger and larger circumstances until she worked with people who had histories of ethnic violence, and they learned to train the people who would be leaders of the future. They would take people in their youth and give them very, you know, maybe 2 weeks a year where they would take them out of their countries and invite them to get to know each other and talk to each other so they could humanize the situation or the universality of the situation and eventually bring peace. But what I'm trying to say, what I think is really interesting is in watching her, there would be the in-between times where she didn't know how she was going to do it. She didn't know how she was going to raise the funds. She didn't know how she was going to develop the capacity. And I remember walking up the stairs to her house one day before one of the big leaps where she was going to take it. Eventually she took it to Washington, D.C. and the State Department, but hearing her crying. So she would work with the fear. She would work with the not knowing. She would work with the doubt and the self-doubt in probably similar ways to Shantideva in terms of encouraging herself, working through the fear, working through all the different capacities of being able to see the negativity in her own mind, which would make her the same as the people she was working with. She was saying that in order to work with people who killed, she had to see and acknowledge her own capacity for killing. So in terms of wishing to part and setting upon the road, there's the wishing to depart and working with what needs to be done in that regard so that then you can start on the road with confidence and with your skills in place. And it says, the wise and learned thus should understand this difference, which is ordered and progressive. And the Tibetans are very, very clear about this, saying that this is so significant because they don't want anyone to give up. It's so important to strengthen the intention so that you carry through with it and not become so afraid or so overwhelmed that you give up. So it's a very human understanding of the frailty of our own goodness. How to approach this, how to maintain the intention and essentially be kind to yourself that you're learning along the way, not that you should already be prepared in every kind of capacity or there's something wrong with you or that you're incapable. So these two verses are quoted many places and many times because they're so very clear. And then we conclude with just these praises, these just beautiful praises of bodhicitta. Bodhicitta in intention bears rich fruit, for those still wandering samsara. So the intention bears rich fruit, certainly, and yet a ceaseless stream of merit does not flow from it, for this will rise alone from active bodhicitta. So we're encouraging ourselves to move from the intention to the action. For when, with irreversible intent, the mind embraces bodhicitta, willing to set free the endless multitude of beings, at that instant, from that moment on, a great and unremitting stream, a strength of wholesome merit, even during sleep and inattention, rises equal to the vastness of sky. Then, moving to verse 21, again a series that both praise and prove bodhicitta as the most precious goal. And I love this because you can just imagine either your mother or you as a mother, father. If with kindly generosity one merely has the wish to soothe the aching head of beings, such merit knows no bounds. So you see yourself soothing your children, soothing your friends, and then you might have the wish to soothe all beings. And you can see how what is natural to you now, then when you expand it, how precious that is, how wonderful it is just to even have the thought of soothing the head of beings. No need to speak then of the wish to drive away the endless pain of each and every being, bringing them unbounded virtues. This pain-dispelling draft, the cause of joy for those who wander through the world, this precious attitude, this jewel of mine, how shall it be gauged or quantified? It's beyond quantifying. For if this simple thought to be of benefit to others exceeds in worth the worship of all the Buddhas, what need is there to speak of actual deeds that bring about the weal and benefit of beings? For beings long to free themselves from misery, but misery itself they follow and pursue. They long for joy, but in their ignorance destroy it as they would a hated enemy. I find this verse so poignantly expressing the human conditions. We had Allison here this summer, and she took a course on addiction. And she was saying she had the most astounding understanding from that course, so that the joy that's naturally produced, for instance, when you eat chocolate, is like here, like, let's say, a foot off the ground. The joy that's produced with sex might be like up to your shoulders. But someone seeking joy who goes to, and it may even be on heroin, the latest biggest drug, would be like a rocket ship. Once you try that, you can never actually have joy in any way naturally because you're longing for something that can't be produced naturally. It's so beyond what any worldly experience, you know, any normal experience would produce. So someone wants joy, but they're destroying it. And that was a really good example for us to hear about, but we all do it in very small, very accessible ways too. You know, we can all relate to, like here we have the light on the porch and you can see all the insects coming to the light and dying. My favorite example is always chocolate. I go for that chocolate and there comes more difficult body experience. So this is the human condition. And so those who show us our ignorance and help us out of that condition, the pain-dispelling draft, the jewel. And then verse 29, but those who fill with bliss all beings destitute of joy, who cut all pain and suffering away from those weighted down with misery, who drive away the darkness of their ignorance, what virtue could be matched with theirs? What friend could be compared to them? What merit is there similar to this? And that's why we love our teacher so much. We come in tears because we're suffering to the great lamas or the great teachers. And they help us take away our ignorance so we see what we're doing. What friend could be better than that? Now you start to get the quality of his dialogue. So he has this example that's so, what could be better, what friend could be more fabulous than that? And then he said, well, even those people who do something nice because they owe someone a favor. Even if they do some good in thanks, for favors once received are praised. Why need we speak of bodhisattvas who freely benefit the world? Those who scornfully with condescension give just once a single meal to others, feeding them for only half a day, are honored by the world as virtuous. What need is there to speak of those who constantly bestow on multitudes the peerless joy of blissful Buddhahood, the ultimate fulfillment of their hopes? To them in whom this precious sacred mind is born, to them I bow, I go for refuge in that source of happiness that brings its very enemies to perfect bliss. So this concludes the first chapter. I invite you to select one verse from this chapter and memorize it or carry it around with you so that you have the chance to contemplate it regularly. And what I find is I can always take one verse from a chapter and use it like a koan. You know, really think about it, really test it out, really see how it applies to how I think normally about things. And so you can see this whole chapter has been about bodhicitta is what you want. It will get you through everything that occurs in life. It will calm every misery. And it will allow you to become someone who can truly benefit others. So having heard his reasoning, how would you prove it to yourself? So I invite you to select a verse and work with it. So now we have a chance for any questions from the chapter. And then we also have a chance to invite the people who have called in. Do we have any questions? I just find this such a celebration of bodhicitta. It's just pure, fabulous poetry. Paula, do you have a question?
Yes, please. Mm-hmm. And thank you so much for the teaching. You speak of being able to dissolve our fears, dissolve our obstacles. Is there a method, particular method that you suggest?
Yes, Paula is asking about dissolving fear and obstacles. As we move into the next chapters, Paula, he actually gives step-by-step on dissolving every conceivable obstacle to enlightenment. And I'm thinking particularly right now of the patience chapter. The patience chapter is so profound that many teachers have written books just on this chapter, and we will definitely go through it thoroughly. I know I've studied it for a month with one teacher. Also, in terms of dissolving boundaries, the 8th and 9th chapters have step-by-step in that. And there's a particular sequence of verses in the 8th chapter. But study the 9th chapter for a month, and I'm actually going to sit with the Dalai Lama on the 9th chapter in 2 weeks. So this is why we study this. I'm not going to say a particular verse right now from the first verse in terms of, well, actually I will. You know, it's all of the verses are so beautiful, it's hard to select one verse in terms of dissolving our boundaries and ignorance. But for me, images are very, very helpful. I would go back to verse 5, as when a flash of lightning rends the night and in its glare shows all that the dark black clouds hid. Likewise, rarely through the Buddha's power, virtuous thoughts arise, brief and transient in the world. I would take that as a beginning step just to have the confidence that the wisdom knowledge that you're seeking can be dispelled like a flash of lightning, and that in combination with the Buddha's continuous aspirations and activities and your virtuous thoughts, your desire and intention to dissolve the boundaries and fearlessness, that there will be that beautiful electric connection of prajna. And to have confidence as we work through the different chapters that you will have a rich bounty of knowledge to address those things. So I think what you're addressing, this is a question about what is obvious and what is not so obvious in terms of the best way of helping beings. And again, as we go through each of the chapters, the wisdom chapter helps us understand how to achieve perfect wisdom ourselves. With wisdom, we would be able to see, a Buddha would be able to see what would be really helpful for every specific individual. So there was someone who was walking with the great Korean master, can't think of his names right now, but the one who had the center in Rhode Island. And they were taking the morning walk, and they encountered one person on the walk who was asking for money, and he reached in his pocket and gave him money. And then later, they encountered another person who was begging, and he looked at him and said, "No, you get a job." He knew which response was appropriate for which person. So you want increasing levels of wisdom and increasing self-understanding. So as you understand through all of your own inner reactions and in all of your interreactions with every kind of mind, then this path, this journey, then eventually gives you the wisdom, because you have a sense of understanding of all the different kinds of minds. So all of it becomes part of the wisdom that you will hold as a Buddha. In the meantime, you start to notice, where is your resistance? When is your resistance arising? And where are you blocked? And where are you fearful? And you work with your blocks and your fears. So just from the sense of attaining meditative stability or stability of mind, you start to see all the different inner reactions that you're having, and you can start to just notice. Hello?
Yes. Osea, this is Barbara Goodfood calling from New Mexico. I wanted to take this opportunity to thank Kenmo for giving us these teachings and to send our love from here over there to you guys. And I know that it's out of the generosity of your own heart that you're there for us. And I just wanted to thank you from deep in my heart. I'm sending you love, and I hope all is well over there. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. How lovely. It was Barbara Goodfood from New Mexico expressing appreciation. How wonderful to hear your voice, Barbara. So Janet was asking again about achieving the wisdom that could actually discern. And this extraordinary poetry takes one straight through in terms of a training manual to enlightenment. Yes, seeing the suffering, seeing the specific antidote that's needed, and helping us let go of reserves and blocks. And okay, we'll try one phone call question. Oh, okay. Marianne? Oh, you will love this, Marianne. This book, I just love it. I just love it. So one of the refrains, you know, is, if I can't step out towards the action I want to take with a bodhicitta state of mind, may I remain like a log. Yes. So it means you stop and deal with your own negative states first. So if we were looking at things from a bodhisattva or a Buddhist perspective, our confusion would be gone. And we would only see different confused states. And our only desire would be to remove confusion. So there's that confusion over there. There's another confusion over here. There's another confusion over here. We would still love the seed of Buddha mind in whatever being we were addressing. I think it was someone responding to the chaos of politics and the craziness of politics at the moment, and finding one's patience tried as one wants to respond. But absolutely, really, this is why I want to go through this whole text, because it astoundingly addresses every mental state, every conceivable mental state. And what is amazing about it is, here was this man in the 700s giving advice that is so universally true, it's still so applicable today. There's a reason why it was one of the six indispensable texts of all the literature that we can imagine. Oh, thank you, Carrie. I do encourage people to read it ahead of time. And sometimes the language can be a little archaic. It was certainly written before any gender issues were raised in the world. So not to worry. And feel free to adjust the language a little bit. Sometimes evil or sin can be replaced by confusion. You know, don't let the language be an obstacle. But yes, once you go into it and start looking at it and looking at how beautifully it was composed and how sincerely he's working with himself, then the richness starts to come through. Absolutely. There's a reason why it's one of my favorite books, getting worn out. Okay, let's go to the bodhicitta prayer, which is the third one in the dedication prayer. Bodhicitta, the excellent and precious mind, where it is unborn, may it arise. Where it is born, may it not decline, but ever increase higher and higher.